Who is behind the militant group known as ISIS, and how have they come to threaten existing Iraqi authorities? Does the rise of this Al-Qaeda offshoot suggest the 11-year-old U.S. intervention there was a failure or a success? How does the U.S.-NATO coalition stand to gain from these developments, and what lies ahead for this beleaguered Middle East state? And what of the Syrian elections? Is there any indication they were fraudulent, as Secretary of State John Kerry has suggested? What does the re-election of Bashar al-Assad mean for U.S. imperial aims for the region? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we will hear perspectives from Michel Chossudovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization and from Mahdi Nazemroya, who was in Syria recently to observe the elections. On this week's program, Iraq and Syria in the Crosshairs, conversations with Michel Chossudovsky and Mahdi Nazemroya. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 20th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, is developing brain chips that will implant or remove specific memories from a subject, a prospect some may deem chilling given DARPA's previous advocacy of authentication microchips. Neuroscientists foresee a brave new world where minds can be programmed using lasers, drugs, and microchips in order to create false memories, a technology that has already been used on mice. Scientists are heralding the beginning of a golden age where minds could be manipulated to function better, although Ledoux acknowledges that ethical implications include the possibility that the application of the technology could lead to the creation of quote-unquote fearless monsters. DARPA's push for brain chips that could erase or implant memories takes on a somewhat sinister tone given the organization's prior advocacy of edible authentication microchips and electronic tattoos that can read a person's mind. Former DARPA director and now Google executive Regina Dugan told an audience at the All Things D11 conference last year that the tech giant was working on a microchip inside a pill that users would swallow daily in order to turn their entire body into a broadcast signal for identification purposes. That comes from the article, DARPA Brain Chips to Implant False Memories, Technology Has the Potential to Create Fearless Monsters, by Paul Joseph Watson, posted June 18th, originally appearing at InfoWars. Members of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIS, were trained in 2012 by U.S. instructors working at a secret base in Jordan, according to informed Jordanian officials. The officials said dozens of ISIS members were trained at the time as part of covert aid to the insurgents targeting the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Syria. In February 2012, WND was first to report the U.S., Turkey, and Jordan were running a training base for the Syrian rebels in the Jordanian town of Safawi in the country's northern desert region. Last March, the German weekly Der Spiegel reported Americans were training Syrian rebels in Jordan. Britain's Guardian newspaper also reported last March that U.S. trainers were aiding Syrian rebels in Jordan, along with British and French instructors. That comes from the article, U.S. Trained ISIS at Secret Jordan Base, posted June 18th, originally appearing at WND. As early as 2007, sources within the Pentagon and across the U.S. intelligence community revealed a conspiracy to drown the Middle East in sectarian war and to do so by arming and funding extremist groups, including the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda itself. The vast scale of U.S., NATO, and Arab aid to terrorists fighting in Syria leaves no doubt that the conspiracy described by Hirsch in 2007 was carried out in earnest, and that the reason Al-Qaeda groups such as Al-Nusra and ISIS displaced so-called moderates was because such moderates never existed in any significant manner to begin with. The plan from the beginning was to raise an extremist expeditionary force to trigger a regional sectarian bloodbath, a bloodbath now raging across multiple borders and set to expand further if decisive action is not taken. Despite an open conspiracy to drown the region in sectarian strife, the U.S. now poses as a stakeholder in Iraq's stability, having armed, funded, and assisted ISIS into existence and into northern Iraq itself. The idea of America intervening to stop ISIS is comparable to an arsonist extinguishing his fire with more gasoline. That's from the article, ISIS Made in USA, Iraq, Geopolitical Arsonists Seek to Burn Region, by Tony Cartolucci, posted June 18th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. Since last autumn, the U.S. government has been lying through its teeth about Ukraine, blaming Russia for the consequences of Washington's actions and demonizing Putin exactly as Washington demonized Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, Assad, the Taliban, and Iran. Russia has witnessed Washington change the role of nuclear weapons in its war doctrine from deterrent to preemptive first strike. And now Russia listens to a daily stream of lies from the West and witnesses the slaughter by Washington's vassal in Kiev of civilians in Russian Ukraine branded terrorists by Washington, by such weapons as white phosphorus, with not a peep of protest from the West. If the White House fool, Washington's media whores, and European vassals convince Russia that war is in the cards, war will be in the cards, as there is no prospect whatsoever of NATO being able to mount a conventional offensive threat against Russia anywhere near the size and power of the German invasion force in 1941 that met with destruction. The war will be nuclear, which will mean the end of all of us. That's from the article, The Lethality of Nuclear War, Washington is Beating the War Drums, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted June 18th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu. Iraq is back in the headlines 11 years after U.S. President George W. Bush led a coalition of the willing into that country to supposedly rescue the free world from Saddam Hussein's notorious weapons of mass destruction. Now, security in the region is being threatened by the aftermath of the U.S. operation, and a debate is being raised about deploying a robust troop presence in the country in the wake of the extremist Islamic group known as the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. Where did this group come from, and how does this complicate or enable U.S.-NATO imperial aims for the region? To answer these questions, I spoke recently with Michel Chosudovsky, director of the Center for Research on Globalization and professor emeritus of economics at the University of Ottawa. Let's talk a little bit about some of the developments that have been happening over the last little while in Iraq. I can assume that what we're seeing in terms of the factionalized fighting, that this is not a question of the U.S. and NATO sort of fumbling the ball, and this is a part of their actual plan?
Well, the Western media, with a few exceptions, have described this unfolding conflict in Iraq as a civil war, opposing the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, which is often referred to the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and the al-Maliki government. They're describing it as a civil war. It's not a civil war. And for that, we have to understand, first of all, what is this Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It is a terrorist entity originally associated to al-Qaeda. It was formed in going back to 2003. It is part of a U.S. intelligence op to create, fund, and equip these terrorist organizations. And up until last year, this was essentially an Iraq-based terrorist entity involved in various operations, including the bomb explosions, the attacks, the and so on, which were waged within Iraq, and now this terrorist entity is involved, or has been involved in Syria for the last year. And it is not by any means an independent entity. And that's what is important in understanding this conflict. The United States pulls the strings within the ranks of these terror brigades. There are Western military advisors, special forces. Often these are special forces of private security companies, but they are in liaison with U.S. NATO command structures, and they do not, these brigades may have a semblance of independence, but ultimately they're serving a geopolitical agenda. And the situation which is evolving now in Iraq is that you have a confrontation between the forces of the Maliki government on the one hand and the terrorist entity, and both sides are supported and financed by the United States of America. And now what is emerging is ultimately a situation where the United States is no longer portrayed as the aggressor nation. It is potentially presented as the mediator in a civil conflict between Sunni and Shiite. But when we look at the broader context, we come to a different understanding, namely that the United States is supporting both sides, and the objective is to trigger sectarian warfare within Iraq, and ultimately leading to the destruction of Iraq as a nation state, and the fracture, the political fracturing of Iraq along ethnic and religious lines, leading possibly to the formation of three separate entities, a Sunni caliphate on the one hand, a Shia republic, which would be made up of whatever is salvaged from the Baghdad government, and then the Kurdistan republic, which is already de facto in the northern region. It's an independent state. So that what I think is unfolding is the transformation of a country into an open territory, fractured. It's an engineered process, and it is there to serve both strategic as well as economic interests by the aggressor nation.
Professor Chossudovsky, I believe, like going back to 2002, 2003, the U.S. Coalition military intervention in Iraq was portrayed pretty, perhaps simplistically, as just an effort to take control of the oil and of that valuable territory. Are we seeing are we seeing an evolution from a sort of a direct takeover and then putting in a compliant government, or are we just seeing just an evolution, that something that's been like organized from the beginning, or have we seen like adjustments made over the last 10 years, like switching to a kind of plan B with the civil war efforts that you're describing?
Well, it's difficult really to answer that question, because there's been many shifts in U.S. foreign policy from one administration to the next, and the present administration is not quite in the same perspective as the neocons under the Bush administration. But what I think we can say is that the formation of a Sunni caliphate has been on the drawing board of U.S. foreign policymakers for quite some time, and it's part of a military agenda. So that the proposed redivision of both Iraq and Syria is what we're dealing with, namely that the United States wants to get rid of Iraq as a unified state. And that, I think, was part of the agenda right from the beginning, and create these three territories. And in turn, they're looking at the broader picture, because if Iran gets involved in this conflict, and the United States is in the process of sucking Iran into the conflict under the pretext that Iran can collaborate in the war on terrorism. In other words, they already have a military cooperation agreement with the al-Maliki government. They have special forces in Iraq. But this invitation by Washington to say that Iran can help us going after the terrorists, first of all, it's an absurd proposition. But secondly, from Iran's point of view, signifies that Iran would be implicated in the civil war, and eventually that civil war could lead to a regional war, because you have Kurds in Syria and Iran, and the project of Greater Kurdistan would, and of course Turkey would suck these countries into a broader regional war, I suspect that is ultimately the scenario of bringing Iran into the Iraq civil war, which is spearheaded by the United States, and then eventually this would lead to a broader conflict and to changes in territorial divisions between different countries in the region, including Syria as well. Syria, Iraq, Iran, and possibly even Pakistan, because Pakistan is a breakaway Baluchistan state, which the separatist movement is supported covertly by British intelligence, and then there's a Baluchistan minority, of course, in Iran. So that the objective is ultimately to weaken the broader Middle East, Central Asian region, carve it up into proxy states, and then open up these territories to foreign investment, rather than have a cumbersome central government in Baghdad. It's a process of destruction of the nation state, of impoverishment, and this has been ongoing in Iraq right from the Gulf War, as we recall. But now, to get to this involvement of Iran, in the Iraq Civil War by saying that Iran can contribute to going after the terrorists, the ISIS terrorists. It's a somewhat absurd proposition because, first of all, the Iranians know that ISIS is supported by the United States. And I assume that people in the White House and the State Department also know that. So it really, but on the other hand, and I should mention this, that today in the Canadian, not today, a couple of days back, in fact, on the same day that John Kerry intimated that, I think it was last Friday, intimated that Iran could help, and they said, of course, Iran can help, but we're not going to enter into any collaboration with them. But there was still a rapprochement between U.S. officials and Iranian officials. On that same day, the National Post in Toronto published an article saying that Ottawa was threatened by a terrorist attack by Iran. And that particular article said, we have evidence, blah, 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 that Iran, in view of the deterioration of relations between Ottawa and Tehran, is preparing to attack the nation's capital. And the RCMP, the Ontario Police, the Quebec, Sûreté du Québec, and, of course, Canadian intelligence, CSIS, everybody is prepared for a possible attack by Iran. And then they say, in the same report, they refer to an al-Qaeda threat, which is an absurd proposition because al-Qaeda is a Sunni terrorist organization and Iran do not support al-Qaeda. And then, coincidentally, the United States invites Iran to collaborate in going after al-Qaeda, namely ISIS, which is an offshoot of al-Qaeda. So you're in a situation where of mass media disinformation, but I would suspect that if Iran gets involved in this conflict, there will also be at one point a process of demonization against Iran, and Iran may be caught up also in acts, criminal acts against the Sunni population, so that in effect, I think what the United States is seeking from a U.S. foreign policy perspective is to create conditions for a broader conflict, which could engulf Syria and Iran, and of course Lebanon. But I should mention that there's another dimension to this, is that when ISIS was created, or let's say the new acronym for ISI, Islamic State in Iraq, last April 2013, they changed the acronym and they called it ISIS or ISIL, meaning that this particular al-Qaeda affiliated organization would extend its activities into Syria. So that but that was a U.S. Initiative. It's a covert undertaking on the part of the United States with Saudi Arabia and Qatar funding these terrorist organizations, but in effect in extending the mandate of ISI to Syria, U.S. foreign policy makers now consider this as a new space, so to speak, and it has a lot to do with the fact that the insurgency in Syria has been defeated, and one avenue for this extended foreign policy agenda is to integrate Syria with Iraq and support covertly terrorist organizations on both sides of the border. And I think that's what they're doing. Now, another important event occurred, and that was a few days before the Syrian elections. Turkey cut off the water supply to the Euphrates, and that had immediate impacts on both Syria and Iraq. It's not to say that this is the first time, and Iraq has been persistently affected by water shortages. And at the same time, the ISIS was involved in a terrorist attack on water facilities, which were instrumental in the supply of water to the Syrian population. And that was that was barely a few days before the Syrian elections on June 3rd. So that we're in a context whereby the country, Iraq, an entire country, is being destroyed, where civil conflicts are being triggered deliberately. As I said, it's not a civil war, because the United States is behind the various parties concerned. It supports covertly ISIS, it supports the Maliki government, and it supplies it with advanced weapon systems, which feeds contracts for Lockheed Martin, and they're even buying F-16 jet fighters. And then it also supports the Kurdistan movement in northern Iraq, and incidentally, Israel is a strong supporter of Kurdistan. So that what we're now seeing is, first of all, the disintegration of the Iraqi state in Baghdad and its government. I would suggest that probably the United States is going. It's not necessarily committed to maintaining that government. They've already implemented regime change in Iraq. They have a regime which is obeying orders from Washington. But now that regime, its days are counted, and then a new political configuration may emerge in the post-Maliki era.
Professor Shostakovsky, we're just about out of time. I was wondering if there's maybe some interesting articles to the Center for Global Research that maybe you want our listeners to check out that help enlighten us on this situation.
Well, we have published quite a number of articles on these recent developments covering various facets of what is actually going on. There's also the issue of the oil industry. There's the very interesting article by Felicity Arbuthnot on the relationship between the Islamic State of Iraq and the oil industry. In other words, because they're occupying certain key areas. I think that while there's a certain state of confusion, it's important to understand the central proposition that ISIS is not an independent terrorist entity. It is an intelligence asset of the U.S. Administration, of U.S. intelligence. It has been set loose quite deliberately in a carefully timed operation. And the objective is ultimately to create havoc and to create conditions for a change in the whole political, social structure of Iraq, which could lead to the formation of three separate states. Some of that is covered in our recent reports. We're publishing on a daily basis at Global Research quite a number of articles. The article by Felicity Arbuthnot, The Iraq ISIS Insurgency and the Anglo-American Battle for Oil, that was published this morning. We're also looking into the whole notion of non-conventional warfare. Okay, a very incisive article by Phil Greaves, entitled "American Imperialism and the Non-Conventional Warfare in Iraq: Premeditated Covert Operations and the ISIS Insurgency."
Okay, Professor Michel Chossadovsky is an award-winning author, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Ottawa, and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. He is also the author of the recent article, "The Engineered Destruction and Political Fragmentation of Iraq Towards the Creation of a U.S.-Sponsored Islamist Caliphate." Professor Chossadovsky, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. On June 3rd, elections were held to determine the presidency of the state of Syria. According to the official results, incumbent Ba'ath Party leader Bashar al-Assad scored a landslide victory with 88.7% of the vote. His rivals Hassan al-Nuri and Maher Hajjar received 4.3% and 3.2% respectively. Are these results tainted as a result of the civil war situation and suppression of the free vote from the governing side, as has been suggested by U.S. officials like John Kerry? What does the election mean for the future of U.S.-NATO policy in Syria and the surrounding region? Joining me right now is Mahdi Nazem Roya. He is a research associate with the Center for Research and Globalization. He was recently in Syria as an election observer. It's nice to have you here, Mahdi.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about your trip to Syria. You observed the elections. How did you, first of all, get to be in that position as an election observer?
Well, I was invited through the Syrian equivalent of the parliament, which is the Syrian People's National Assembly of the Syrian Arab Republic. I arrived in Syria via Lebanon. I had to drive from Beirut on the Beirut-Damascus highway through Bekaa and go to Damascus from there. I was there a few days before the election. I was one of several international observers. In total, I believe there was approximately 50 international observers that were in Damascus. The majority of which were members of parliament or officials from other countries like the Russian Federation, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Brazil, Bolivia, the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, Uganda, the Philippines, and Tajikistan. These were just some of the countries that sent international observers and members of parliament there. I would like to mention also that while I was in Lebanon, while I was in Beirut, the electoral process had already begun. And Lebanon is the country with the highest ratio or proportion of Syrian refugees outside of Syria, followed by, I believe, Turkey or Jordan. In Lebanon, there's over 1 million refugees. About over 95% of them went to vote. The embassy didn't even have enough ballots for all of them. Some of them had to go back to Syria across the border to vote on election day because the embassy could not facilitate all of them. They even had to extend electoral hours. And I think there's a really good inference that we can make from the election, the voting in Lebanon. The Syrian refugees who voted were not forced, so no one can say that everyone who voted in this election was forced or intimidated by the regime in Damascus. Those people all freely wanted to vote, and most of them, the vast majority of them, displayed support for Bashar al-Assad and the Ba'ath Party. So they had posters of him or T-shirts with his picture, and they were singing chants about him. So we can see in Lebanon, there's a litmus test here about the freeness of these elections. And everything that I saw in Lebanon or know about occurring in Lebanon dispels the accusations that this election was forced on the people and was unfair.
Well, the rhetoric around the Assad regime is that he's a dictator, he's a brutal dictator, and people basically take it as a given that a dictatorial leader has ways of restricting or coercing the population or otherwise fiddling around with election results to get the results that they want. And you're saying that that there's no way that those sorts of things could have happened?
I am saying that this election was, from my observations, as someone who's worked for Elections Canada, as someone who's also been an international observer prior to this, and knows about the electoral process, it seemed to be a relatively fair election. I saw technocratic flaws and things that could be questioned, but they were very minor. It was very clear that Bashar al-Assad had popular support. All the observers I talked to for the areas that they were responsible and assigned to had the same views. We talked about the similar flaws, but relatively speaking, the spirit of the elections was fair. There was scrutineers for the other two candidates, and there was a popular voting. I believe about 74%, over 70% of the eligible voters, and what I mean by eligible voters is people who were 18 years, at least 18 years old on the date of the elections, and who did not have a criminal record, were eligible voters. About 70% of these people voted. And while I brought up the issue of people with criminal records or felons, that was only around 100 and something odd people were disqualified from voting. But this is out of a population of approximately 24 million, and about 15 million were eligible voters. That means 15 million were people who were over 18 years of age on election day.
Now, I'm wondering, isn't it? I mean, the country is in a state of civil war. I mean, we've got these insurgencies and you've got, violent reprisals. I think the impression a lot of people have is that this would generate a chaotic situation. That, however virtuous the regime or the government might be, that there would by necessity be flaws in trying to compile and tally the results appropriately. Is there were there no concerns in that regard?
There were concerns, and these were questions that I and others brought up when we met with people in charge of the electoral process. By that, I mean the judges and the members of the Syrian Arab Republic's Electoral Commission and the Constitutional Court. These questions were brought up, and they made the elections flexible. I mean, in Lebanon, for example, the elections went past the mandated hours, voting hours. And the reason they did that is to try to facilitate everyone to vote. In Syria, they said if there were problems from the insurgents, and the insurgents did threaten to murder people who would vote, they said that they would be flexible on issues like that. Being issued an ID, for example, was very simple at this time. So if somebody wanted to vote, they could get an ID relatively quick within that day, if possible. They would speed things up. The other thing was, because of the fighting in the Syrian Arab Republic, the entire country was treated as one single electoral precinct because of that. So someone from Aleppo could vote in Latakia, or someone in Homs could vote in Damascus. So they treated the entire country as one precinct, electoral precinct, and that was to facilitate this. They made a lot of concessions in those terms to try to facilitate voting. The other thing was the elections were supposed to start at 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., but they were willing to extend hours. They were willing to help transport people if they needed to vote. And another phenomenon that I noticed, that now that I'm talking about this, is a lot of Syrians would fly in from outside of the country, from places like Kuwait, the United Kingdom, the United States of America, Italy, to come vote inside Syria. And one of the reasons for that was because their embassies were not allowed to, there was either no diplomatic relations or their embassies were not allowed to to let the elections take place. So these people would rather come back to their country from Turkey or the United Arab Emirates or Kuwait to vote, to show their support. And I've actually met people, for example, in Tartus on the coast of the Mediterranean. I met someone from Italy, a man who came to vote. I met someone from the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland who also came to vote. I met various people coming from outside of the country to vote.
Mm. Could you talk more about the threats to your personal security as an election observer? Were there some areas of the country that it was more of a concern?
Well, I mean, we were given protection. We were afforded protection, of course.
And you felt safe.
Feeling safe and being safe are two different things. Some people might have not felt safe while they were, and some people might have felt safe when they weren't. We were afforded protection. That means we were given security and bodyguards, essentially. We went in convoys. They were protected. I flew from Damascus, the capital, to the coasts. I flew to Latakia, the governorate of Latakia. The governorate's a province or a state. I flew into Latakia with Russian officials, North Korean officials, and Pakistani observers, as well as one other Canadian, one American citizen. We flew to Latakia. They took the north of the coast, so they stayed in Latakia governorate, while I went to Tartus governorate from Latakia. And I went to I even went to a city where the recreation center was turned into a refugee camp. They don't call them refugees. They call them internally displaced. But I went there to see them vote, and there was people there from Aleppo or from the far east of the country, some areas on the Iraq border. There was even Palestinian refugees being housed there, and they set up polls there. I think in all there was over 11,000 polls, 9,000 pollings and 9,000 polling stations throughout the country. And they took care of our security. Other people went to other places, like I know that a delegation of parliamentarians went to the governorate or province of Aleppo. Others were in the governorate or province of Damascus. Others were went to the Swaida. Some went to Homs. I don't know if anybody went to Idlib. I don't remember that. But we were spread out, and basically the whole country was had election observers. The Latin Americans were in the south. I recall that.
Okay. Were there no incidents or any significant incidents of intimidation of voters that you're familiar with?
I am aware of incidents of intimidation, but they were not from the government side. They were not from the government of Bashar al-Assad. The intimidation was from the insurgent side. So they did threaten to kill people or their families if they voted. There was actually the areas that the insurgents controlled are essentially being depopulated. People were trying to escape from them, and people did leave them to come vote. I spoke to people who were threatened, and their message was that we don't care. We're here right now, and this is the only way to save our country. We don't have many people. I want to make this categorically clear. Many Syrian citizens, the people of Syria society, made it very clear that they saw this election as a means of saving their country. They said that we're doing this to save our country, ourselves and our families. So they saw this vote as paramount to establishing security in their country. And that was one of the main reasons many people voted. There was even people who did not like Bashar al-Assad who would vote, but they voted because they saw this as a means of saving their country, and they voted for him. So, I mean, they saw this as a vote for Syrian unity and Syrian stability and restoring order in Syria. And that's very important to note. In fact, this was more of a referendum in my eyes than it was an election. It was a referendum to reconfirm or restate the legitimacy of the Syrian government and the Syrian president in the eyes of the Syrian people. And I think that's what many people should focus on when they think of the election, presidential election that took place in Syria.
Okay, so what you talk about it being effectively a referendum. What was it? Could you identify exactly what it was about the alternatives that may have caused concern for the populace?
Well, when we speak about alternatives, there's two types of alternatives I'd like to construct for listeners. One alternative was the other presidential candidates. There were only two other presidential candidates. I believe 30 to 40 people approximately applied to become presidential candidates. But like most other places in the world, there's a filtration system. I mean, in the United States, I believe if you have a criminal record or you're not born in the United States, you can't run for president. Or in Argentina, if you're not a Roman Catholic, you can't run for president. So every system of governance, every democracy has some type of filter. In Syria, you needed, I believe, a certain amount of members of the National Assembly, basically parliamentarians or deputies, to sign a paper of support. So only three candidates were able to get this. And the other thing that you needed to be eligible to run for the office of president of the Syrian Arab Republic was to live in Syria for an X number of years, for a specific time. And because of these criteria, not everybody was able to make it. Not everybody got other members of parliament or deputies to sign their papers. So the two candidates that did was someone who's aligned to who's a communist essentially, and the other one was a neoliberal economist. I think that the communist candidate or the socialist candidate, who's part of who was part of a coalition that includes the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, as well as the socialist communists. I believe that he's been a long-standing political alternative in Syria. His party has. I've read that there's been some tensions within the party, and some people have delinked or disassociated. But the other gentleman, the economist I'm talking about, I look at him more as a token opponent. I think a lot of people there did too. Now, in regards to the other type of alternatives, the other type of alternative were foreign proxies. The insurgents and the Syrian National Coalition, based in Istanbul and Qatar and Doha, these were the other alternatives, and these were looked at as traitors, foreign puppets, vassals, people who would surrender to not only the United States and the Arab petro-sheikdoms of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, but also to Israel, or as they call it in Syria, the Zionist regime. They were looked at as basically, these were the alternatives on a political level, as well as on the ground, the insurgents that would kill people, the anti-government forces who were torturing and murdering and raping and plundering, the same type of insurgents that we now see in Iraq, destroying the Federal Arab Republic of Iraq, in Mosul, killing thousands of prisoners. So that was the other alternative. It was people who wanted to set up some type of emirate, who didn't believe in democracy, and who would essentially be pawns of U.S. and Turkish and Saudi and Israeli and British interests.
Mm. So is there anything – I mean, of course, the Western press and leaders are suggesting that the elections were somehow tainted. Did you see anything else that – sort of suggests dirty tricks on the part of Western forces that have their own agenda for Syria?
Well, I did see, I was looking at what the media in places like Britain or France or Germany or the United States or Canada was reporting, like the Montreal Gazette or the National Post or the Globe and Mail or the Washington Post or Fox News. I looked at what the British Broadcasting Corporation would say, and they were very disconnected from facts on the ground. In fact, some of them, like The Guardian, would say there was no international observers there. So they didn't know about reality. I saw in cases where they were talking about the refugees in Jordan, they were giving the numbers from Libya, from Lebanon. No, in Jordan, the refugees are just under 1 million, but they were giving the figure from Lebanon, so they didn't know their facts. The facts, they weren't correct about the facts. And they were basically brushing off and selling off the elections as fraud automatically without knowing what was happening on the ground. They were saying that it was rigged, unfair. And interesting enough, the United Kingdom's foreign minister, or I should say foreign secretary, William Hague, he said that the elections were illegitimate because they were taking place during a civil war. Well, the irony is Mr. Hague recognized the elections in Ukraine, the presidential elections that took place in the same time frame, while they took place in exact similar conditions, while there was fighting in the eastern portion of the country, while the Ukrainian military and the National Guard were involved in military operations in eastern Ukraine, in places like Donetsk. And the United States and Great Britain had no problems in recognizing these elections, but their standards are different for Syria. So, I mean, I looked the other way and just tisked at what William Hague and others had to say. I know that the Secretary of State, John Kerry for the United States, was also in Lebanon while I was in Syria, and he also made similar statements and basically lamented against the Syrian government and against Lebanon's Hezbollah and against Iran and against Russia. But I think it's utter hypocrisy, and I think they're not reflecting or even trying to reflect any truth about what happened in Syria during the presidential elections.
So is there anything else about the Syrian elections that you just observed that you think listeners need to reflect on?
I think that the elections, maybe from a moral standpoint, they needed them for inner morality. But I think that they weren't necessary at all because Bashar al-Assad was – it was very clear that the other candidates – couldn't win. I mean, throughout the entire country, people supported the man. He had popular support. And I went to more, I went around Syria. So I was in the countryside. And you asked me about security, for example. Well, I was in the south and I was close to the front. And I had to stop for a time because fighting was near me before I returned to the city of Damascus from Damascus countryside, you know. I pretty much saw the country, and you saw that there was support behind Bashar al-Assad. So the president has popular support, and the elections, I think, were just to prove that there was legitimacy for the government. I don't think it was an election an internal election. I think it was an election to demonstrate something to the outside world. And I also think that it was my educated guess that military operations would be ramped up after the election. I think that speaking to people in Syria, they were holding back on some operations, not to instigate or to poke the hornet's nest, in so many words, so the elections could go through as smoothly as possible. They were waiting for a successful election in Syria, and then after that, they were going to ramp up military operations. You know, they knew already where some cells of insurgents were. They left them alone, so the elections could take place with minimum violence and disruption. And then after that, they can ramp up military operations against these anti-government forces. The other thing that I'd like to mention about the presidential elections in the Syrian Arab Republic is that I think that it makes the Geneva, I think it makes the process in Geneva obsolete. I from the very beginning, was against the Geneva conference. I thought it was a scam. It was basically the Syrian government negotiating with the paymasters and overlords of these insurgents. basically the United States and its and its proxies and allies. And I think now this is the end for that consensus in Geneva, which was at the very beginning nefarious and something the United States wanted to use as a tool against Syria, as well as its regional and international allies. And I think this has put the nails in the coffin for that entire Geneva process that was bankrupt from the very beginning.
Okay. Well, in that case, I mean, we've seen that all pretense aside, I mean, the Western countries, NATO, have had their own plans for Syria and the geopolitical chessboard. How far away are they from their ultimate goal, or how do they alter their strategy at this point?
Well, I think they've lost. Very frankly, I think they lost. I saw this as a downward spiral for them. But that doesn't mean they're going to stop. In their endeavors. The endeavors, they have not stopped. They're going to re-strategize, and that's what they've been doing for the last decade. Failure after failure, they've re-strategized. I mean, in 2006, they attacked Lebanon, but Syria was the main target. After they lost in Lebanon and they were defeated by Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance, the Israelis I'm talking about, but this was an operation that involved the U.S., U.S. planning, U.S. strategists, as well as NATO. After they lost, what did they do? They went to a project, they started a policy. It's an old policy, actually. They used it in Afghanistan, but Seymour Hersh, for example, calls it the redirection, sectarian fighting. You know, using Salafists against their enemies. And you see in Lebanon what happens after 2006. Well, they brought groups like Fatah al-Islam into the Palestinian camps in Tripoli, and that backfired on them. So instead of attacking Hezbollah, Fatah al-Islam ended up fighting the Lebanese state, fighting against the Lebanese army in the Palestinian camps. And those characters from Fatah al-Islam actually ended up fighting in the insurgency. Groups that are tied to this project ended up backfiring and attacking the people in Lebanon that wanted to attack Hezbollah. There's people like Ahmed al-Asir, who was in Saida or Sidon in central Lebanon, towards the south, actually. Mm-hmm. These type of characters they've proven to be incapable.
That was Mahdi Nazem Roya. He's a research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization and was recently in Syria as an election observer. That concludes our show. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our program every week on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across the country. The show can be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. and can be downloaded from the website globalresearch.ca. Thank you for joining us. If you have any questions or comments about today's program, feel free to send your feedback to globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Join us again next week.